Here's the big question this show answers. How do we leverage technology and human science to positively impact our personal and professional life? The Tech Human Experience has the answer. Here's your host, Inc. 5000 tech founder, neuroscience junkie, and Navy SEAL wannabe, Javier Guerra.
Hello, my fellow tech humans. Today's guest is a program manager and developer advocate, deeply committed to growing the New Orleans tech community. As a certified Scrum Master and co-founder of the Agile User Group, he's more than just a practitioner. He's a guide and a mentor. Whether it's agile frameworks, DevOps, or community building, our guest is at the forefront. Please welcome Dustin Gaspard. Thank you for your time today, Dustin.
Yeah, thank you, Javier. Happy to be here, man.
Yeah, always good talking with you. So let's get started with the fact. According to Goodreads, self-help books make up an $800 million market in the U.S. Do you have any go-to self-development books that really had a significant impact on your life?
So technology-wise, I'm always reading those engineering manager type books. One that was really interesting for me was Powerful by Patty McCord. She was a executive of HR at Netflix, and she kind of talks about like the steps she had to take and the things she had to do in order to make Netflix the way it was and what choices she made in order to really have when the company really took off. And it kind of shaped the way I started thinking about performance management and people on my teams, because she has a little bit harder line than I do. You know, in my past, I've always been like, we're going to do everything we can to make everything work. It gave me some really interesting perspective.
And what do you mean by harder line? I'm doing a...
So Netflix has a term, it's outlined in her book that says, hey, we are not a family, we are a team. And every year, like a professional football team, we will reassess exactly what we need and, you know, where do we get better and things like that. So, and I guess my go-to, right, as becoming a first-time leader, first-time manager, first-time director, was always like, if I see somebody failing on my team, I'm like, I'm going to work over an extra to get that person succeeding. Right. Mm-hmm. So it set me back like, oh, wow. For a lot of other people, there's a line like, if, you know, that you got to work this hard. You got to do these things. You got to be this technical. You got to, you know, this adaptable to stay here. So it really broadened me as a manager as I started learning, leading more teams at scale. Mm-hmm. Right. And seeing things fall apart when
I like that. You know, it makes me think. One of the ways that I work to approach things is I will tell my team, the entire organization, as if anybody doesn't work out here or there's any problems in the company, like that's my fault. Because as a leader, you know, I'm gifted with seeing the big picture and just, you know, futurist is one of my top strengths. Gallup strengths is my number one strength, right? And so I have the ability to just see patterns and in a sense kind of almost see how the future is unfolding or it's going to unfold. I take it on as a responsibility. If somebody's failing and I'm not slowing down enough to help them, right, as a coach or as a mentor or whatever, then, you know, if I'm not doing my 100% best job at doing that, then it's my fault, right? If they're not making it, right? Because I didn't slow down enough to help them or maybe give them enough tools or give them enough time to help them see something that they're missing. And, you know, I'll have this conversation with the team around, you know, our DNA, literally our DNA is packed with like the equivalent of 80,000 CD-ROMs of data, but that is a significant amount of untapped potential there. And by coaching, by leading, by putting people in situations where they're out of their comfort zone, that can unleash that potential within them. And literally if you study epigenetics and all that stuff, the environment and how we are leading, it has a huge effect. And it just makes me think about that.
Yeah, for me, the question I always ask myself is, how much ambiguity did I just leave as a leader, right? When I try to convey a vision or a mission or a goal or something to my team, did I say, this is how fast we need to move, this is the things we need to do? Did I remove as much ambiguity as possible for the people who report to me and the people who report to them be able to accomplish their goal? Because that's really that's most of the equation most of the time is especially in a world where we're all disconnected and we're all on Zoom all the time, it is so easy to lose so much context from conversation to conversation. And people, their tendency is to stand still and wait until tomorrow. Oh, we'll stand up tomorrow, so I'll ask that question then. And all those little 4 hour gaps lose time, right? Like they add up over teams over time. So it's always when I see somebody not moving at the speed I need, or performing the way I want, usually it's like, did I leave ambiguity that's causing them from moving forward?
Yeah, I love that. It's so important because that's literally an area where I struggle, and I leverage coaches and counselors and you name it, communications experts. It is, my another one of my top Gallic strengths is learner. I'm constantly learning, constantly learning. Right, my wife makes fun of me because I just have so much information that I'm constantly absorbing. But what happens is I can, like, fall into the trap of not communicating very clearly because I'm trying to put on too much information when I'm communicating, right? And so that's somewhere where I need to bounce it off somebody of like, how can I communicate this more clearly, effectively, and straight to the point?
Yeah, and I think you also have to time it with repeating remembering how to empower people all the time. And the reason being, executives tend to be extremely initiative, like self-driven, right? And dealing with ambiguity all the time and dealing with risk all the time. Every decision you make, every time you talk, there's some level of risk and ambiguity. And you just say, well, I'm going to figure it out, right? And but you think about a junior developer on a team. There's very little ambiguity in that role. Their IDE is set up for them, so they know how to code. There's someone whose entire job is to break down all the work into them in manageable chunks, so they have to solve that very specific problem. And if they run into an issue, they can go back to that person and say, "What about this or that?" So, as an executive, I think, or any leader, we tend to forget how much people aren't exposed to ambiguity at that bottom level. And so again, they go back to just freezing and waiting until someone else helps them resolve that ambiguity. So go get rid of it. You got to combat it with empowerment. Hey, look, just take a risk. Worst comes to worst, you're going to be 6 hours behind on schedule, but all you did was sit there for 6 hours. So at least now you did something wrong. You got it right. We can use 80% of what you did.
Yeah, yeah.
It's better. And
Keep
it's
moving. Keep the momentum
yeah
going.
yeah
Yeah. No, I love that. So let's dive into today's topic. From tech lead to human-centric, a new approach to organizational success. We'll explore how focusing on the human aspect can lead to more successful and sustainable technological advancements. So Dustin, let's talk a little bit about community building and really technology perception in New Orleans, which is where you're really headquartered out of. How have you been, well, not necessarily headquartered, but this is where you live, right, in New Orleans. How have you been really been involved in rejuvenating the tech community in New Orleans, especially after, COVID?
Yeah, hate to toot my own horn a little bit, but I will here. Kind of instrumental would be the word I would use. So coming out of 2020, we had a vibrant tech community prior to COVID, but it kind of broke apart. A lot of the people who were really engaged had moved on, or the exact opposite, planted deeper roots and had children. And the idea of restarting all the meetups and restarting the community, not exactly easy for people without those options. So about a year and some change ago, Garrett Majoway and I, we got back together and we brought back an old group called Agile NOLA that we had would stun back in 2012, back when we were Scrum Masters. And we brought it back a little bit, took the dust off, revamped it a little bit. Now we don't concentrate strictly on agile things. We go all over the place, anything from AWS architecture to AI developments that are happening. We still keep our core of agile stuff that we bring from month to month. From there, the way that it's kind of like rise and inspire people, one of the reasons I chose to like skip topics a little bit, or like skip around on topics, is I wanted people to come and be excited that there was a community of things getting together and they can talk about the things that excite them, but just frustrated enough that we don't stay on a particular topic that they have to start their own event. So since then, I've helped a number of different people kickstart their own group, right? So like front end party, now there's a NOLA Sec party. Recently, I didn't have anything to help this, but now there's a women in tech group that started in New Orleans. So, but either we've been had our hands dealt in, or we've kind of helped and inspired and also thrown some cash behind people so they can have pizzas and stuff like that at each one of these meetups.
Nice, nice. That, you know, it's something that's really been, I guess, hit hard in San Antonio specifically, right? There's, since COVID, a lot of the better groups that were coming together kind of fizzled out a bit. So it's something that really we've been working on locally in alignment with some already existing groups that we've been working to scale and build and bring more value to the community. So it's, I definitely feel you there. It's important. And I'm glad that you're doing that because, you know, it's as humans, right? It's like we're wired for community, and just having that, those different perspectives, it's literally tapping into other people's intelligence and whatever experience they have and being able to triangulate ideas and problems off of each other. We move the needle and solve problems so much better. So it's extremely powerful, been very beneficial for me to tap into these different networks and from scaling Tech Human and evolving Tech Human, but also for our clients, right? We're big connectors of getting people together, their peers across the nation, to help them to solve problems. So it's good stuff. Good that you're doing that there in New Orleans.
Yeah. Thank you. It's been great. And that's been like the number one piece of feedback we got. We have what I call a large amount of digital nomads in New Orleans. So people who work for these large companies or even these smaller companies, and they're accomplishing really great things, big things, bleeding edge things. And then they come each month and they're like, man, I'm just so happy. I have like a group of people that I can talk to, right? My spouse or my friends, they can't talk to me about these things at this level, right? That conversation has been awesome. And it's been a way, I would say, easier than I expected to get it off the ground. There was a lot of excitement behind it. Just took a little bit.
Yeah, it definitely takes work. That's for sure. Teamwork. So, you know, bridging technology and business, you know, in alignment with this thought process or this topic, in your opinion, how critical is the role of project management in aligning tech and business objectives with an organizational strategy?
It's pretty critical. This is a question I've asked myself a lot over the last 20 years. I feel like the project manager role can be a little contentious. Like there's either some camp that's like it's the most important role in a team, and then other people say, I have no idea what this person does. All right. So, but as a project manager role, I've had to shine a light on what the team does and what the value they bring to the organization. There are a lot of non-technical companies that don't see the value of their dev teams, right? Like, and that sounds a little harsh, but I mean, I do have some really strong conversations with some, you know, C-level and VP-level people to make them understand the value they're bringing to their organization. You know, when you go to a 5,000 foot CFO level, it almost feels like, oh, I'm going to build this new project. And it's almost like I'm building a new building. And then explain to them, no, what these people are going to do is going to be morphing with you every day. Like your data is throwing through this. This is about to be the future of your company when we're building this custom software. So I've as a project manager, I've had a lot of transformative conversations to make sure that the VP level understand the contribution that the dev team is having. You do that in numerous ways. One, narrative, but then you back up your narrative with data, right? Which is what the project manager is usually probably famous for. Like, here are my charts, here are the things where I'm showing. And then good project management from the other side of the fence is really about showing transparency and showing what the team can and can't do under the constraints that they have, whether it's time, resources, scope, and really making sure that everybody's on the same page. Especially in this COVID world where we're all separated, that maintaining scope, that maintaining the narrative, like this is what we're delivering, the project manager's role is becoming a little bit more important than I would say it was when everybody was in the same room and we got to talk. And you say, hey, turns out this is going to take 4 weeks instead of two. Can we scrap this? And then by the end of the day, it's all around everybody. Now with the remote world, by the time it gets around, the conversation's either forgotten about or morphed. So project manager right now, I would say, is a little bit more important to keep that narrative and keep that scope than ever.
Yeah, it I've always seen it as very important. I was actually on the board of the Project Manager Institute locally, 15 years ago. And so I went through project management training. And so what I've always seen it as, it's, the human technology is what I call it, is so important. And projects a lot of times can get off budget, they can creep, there's scope creep, there's all these types of projects that are going on at the same time. And that is really the livelihood, I think, more and more as time or as the business landscape and the technology landscape evolves, it is really every company now is becoming a technology company. And this is the future of these companies, because if you're not leveraging technology, then you're going to probably get taken out by a more nimble, innovative company that comes in and provides a better service to the end client by leveraging technology, right? Faster, better experience, more efficient, whatever. And those project managers are kind of like the glue that holds it together to keep things on track, and really is to be able to leverage the human technology, I like to say, and align that with the business strategy to help execute in an efficient manner. But also it's so important as the future unfolds to keep these people engaged and feeling like they're moving the needle, because the talent shortage is becoming a bigger and bigger problem as the future unfolds and new jobs are needed being filled. Because it's not just that there's not enough talent and there's not being enough being pumped out from the schools, it's that everything's evolving. And so there's like two double whammies that are going to make the issue bigger and bigger. So it's project managers are so important, in my opinion.
Yeah. Where I see, and if there's any piece of advice for any project managers out there, I would say just empower yourself or talk about conversations about how far you can push your influence as soon as possible. Because I've seen so many project managers who kind of just sit there and say, well, those people don't report to me, so I can't tell them to do X, Y, and Z. Or I'm not the executive who can choose, make this choice or anything like that. So I see, projects stall out, or with someone who sees the issue, because no one else has the insight of seeing what the customers want, what the stakeholders want, and what the development team is doing, like the PM. But at the same time, you can feel like you're in handcuffs, because like you have to influence everyone. No, you don't really have authority over many people. So if you can get involved and try to take a lot more ownership, right? Then don't be scared to take ownership. Take a little risk.
Yeah, agreed. And I really believe that the best project managers are able to get that higher level of authority, whether it's CEO or CFO or COO, whoever's, really the top decision maker, is really getting their buy-in and getting their blessing to really kind of have that indirect dotted line authority to kind of push things forward. But then being able to be a master communicator and a motivator and really putting things in a perspective that those people that they're affecting and that they're having to get on board with this change or driving the process forward, that they're able to tie the benefit of what are they going to get out of it, right? And so it's such an important skill with project managers. Let's talk a little bit about technology projects. So, I'm sure you've dealt with complex, larger technology projects. What's been your approach, I guess, in really handling those more complex, intricate technology projects?
Yeah, my first question is always, what is the MVP? All right, I know we have this pie in the sky idea, I know we have a vision, I know we have a mission, but like, if we lost all our resources and all our money, like, what do we have to deliver, right? And then I start with that end goal, right? And what's it going to take to maintain that end goal? And then I start working my way backwards. So I I would, that's usually my go-to, like right off the bat, and figure out who's all involved in every decision piece. So if I have a new product I'm trying to bring up in, say, the government space, right? And it does all these things for, say, HR, you know, what is the first milestone to get to production as fast as possible? I say get to production as fast as possible, even before milestone one is complete, because you learn so much the moment you get to production. And I've seen so many really great apps that have been built for a year, and then their production release gets pushed back months because they didn't know about security compliance. They didn't know about how to really properly manage their environment variables in the dev environment. Like, you know, there's a lot of undocumented things and use cases. I mean, really, if you have a really big problem, the moment you get a login page and a report in your app, try to get it to production. You'd be surprised how priorities shift completely once somebody has a working thing in front of them.
Yeah. And then, you know, getting that end user feedback is huge too, right? So it's getting the feedback of the end user, because a lot of times, well, not a lot of times, I would think that just in general, like, we have this perception and this knowledge in our head or of how we think it's going to roll out and how we think it's going to evolve. But once people start getting their hands on it, the end user specifically, they know their roles better than we do, right? And so they get their hands on it. They're like, well, what about this? What about this? What about this? So that feedback is so valuable. And that's, you know, what I think is the beauty about an agile approach is just get it out there before it's perfect, right? Get it out, get it into the hands of the end user and start getting that feedback so that you can kind of move the needle and build, measure, learn, so to speak.
Right. And one part I don't know if the delivery teams ever really think about too much is also that training, adoption, that change management aspect of it. So when you're rolling things out to your customers, how do people start adopting this slowly but surely? It's a lot easier to say, hey, we had a small update. Now here's your 30 seconds of training and you're good to go, versus we've been building something for 3 years now and your entire job is about to change. Here's how.
Yeah.
So there is
adjustments.
So there is an aspect of that you want to be careful about, right? Like you don't want to shock. I see a lot of technology rollouts, big rollouts, and you know, and the plan is we're going to build this for 3 years and then we're going to do this massive change to people's roles. But if you just edge people into it, right, get their buy-in along the way through interviews and asking them, you know, does this work, does this not work, and then also getting them involved in the UAT process, the user acceptance testing, but then also getting them involved in like the smaller rollouts, all of a sudden the buy-in and the adoption and the training gets a lot easier.
Yeah, it's so important. You know, I'm presenting on change in January at a local health information management society event. And it's, you know, in my opinion, in a lot of very smart people's opinion, experts in this space, is that we really need to align that change with the human behavior, right? The human psyche, the human everything, because it's, if you study humans, they don't like to change. They resist, right? And so if you're not approaching things in the right way, you can be creating massive amounts of waste, not only from an operational perspective, from a financial perspective, from a time perspective, from like you name it. You could lose great talent because of pushing so much change on the organization at once and shocking those people and that human technology that is wired to be resistant to change. It really has to be very methodically planned out and executed so that you're kind of easing them into that change and they really understand the value that what is in it for them in the short term and in the long term, so that you can mitigate the risk of resistance and fallout.
Yeah, there's one thing I think delivery teams have in spades that they don't realize their customers don't. If you're an engineer, you tend to be the type of person who takes new information and adapts it to what you know really quickly. There's some people that just need to be exposed to something and touch it two or three times before they can really like accept that change is happening. Right. So that communication part that you're talking about, like, and having a very structured approach to having, we're going to use the right words, we're going to say them in the right order, we're going to, and then sticking to the plan. Even if though you find like a better way to push your plan, sometimes, a lot of the times, like sticking to the communicated plan is actually better than that last minute audible, right? Just because people won't react so negatively when they, just because the change for change's sake,
Emerging technologies, let's touch on this, right? And but in your opinion, over the next few years, what emerging technologies do you think are going to have a very significant impact in your industry?
You got to go with AI, right? There's nothing like it. I do think its long-term implications are going to be huge. I do think it's going to take us a lot longer to get there than we realize. We're seeing like massive changes every day. Large language models were really awesome, but the concept of productionizing this, when I talk to leaders at large companies, their number one issue right now is they can't get access to their data to make decisions that they want to make. So they have to go on a gut check. Well, just because there's an AI tool there doesn't mean the data's ready. And what's wrong? Why don't they have the data? Well, if you're a Fortune 5 energy company, you have multiple ERPs that have been built over decades. You have SaaS products that all your teams are buying that you're not even sure what they own or their data's in. You have multiple data warehouses owned by different groups, and then you have a bunch of products that, so we need to get all that data into a warehouse or a lake or someplace. That way the AI can actually tell us what the truth is. And it has to be clean data. We need to have data governance, data policies. We have to make sure that the right people see the right data. I think those kind of hurdles, that governance and policy, to making sure that things are safe and secure and that the wrong people don't get access to the wrong data, is gonna be some major hurdles that we need to figure out before AI can really take over. I think we need to be looking at AI, and I definitely think we need to be toying with it. But one thing I don't see a lot of people doing right now is preparing for it by getting that clean data in place, because it's not a sexy product filled with a bunch of new features, right? It's like, I gotta go clean my house. And it's
Yeah,
gonna cost a lot of money.
I was thinking the exact same thing. It boils down to human behavior, right? And so our attention span is so, it's being trained to be so like minimal, like the amount of time that we have that keeps our attention. If it's not exciting, if it's not new and it's not innovative, it's not as typically able to capture our attention as much. And so we keep kind of going to these shiny objects, and I'm guilty of that, right? I'm all over AI, and I'm continuously learning, and basically 7 hours a week, I'm now committed to learning how to continuously evolve Tech Human AI, which we've built, right? And that we're helping our customers with. And so it's but at the end of the day, it's only going to be as powerful as the data and the data governance and all those policies in place. Because if you don't have that clean data, well, then it's not going to be able to ingest it properly, and you're not going to get an intelligent output. So it's so important, and it's just going to become more and more of a need as everything advances. So it's a challenge. So it's going to be interesting to see how the next few years unfold. Absolutely, for sure. Okay, so let's talk a little bit more about personal development and like talent pipelines. From your perspective, what really drives your passion for developing talent and helping your team succeed, or just people succeed in tech specifically?
I was a software developer for about 15 years before I got into leadership. And then after being in leadership for about 6 months, I realized that I always enjoyed solving problems, but I enjoy solving people problems more. To watch someone who is just starting out their career hit all these major milestones, it's not as good as watching your own kids grow up, but man, it's as close as possible. It is to see I get more excited sometimes of seeing people's growth and the way they not only manage themselves but to manage others than I do. I would say maybe hitting a major deliverable, right? So people has always been it's just, I don't even have to work at it. It's a passion.
Yeah. It's so important. And it's for you to be aware of like what fulfills you, right? And do a lot of work on here. And I have a 19-year-old, I have a 2-year-old. I've been doing this work with my son since he was very young. He's extremely advanced in self-awareness, and just, I mean, I've sent him through multi-day transformational programs that, you know, I know some people, you know, much older than me that have never done anything remotely like that. So he's extremely well-rounded at 19 years old. And now we're actually doing this with our two-year-old, to where it's like every night, you know, before bed, she prays, she says her affirmations. And I'm just like, it's almost mind-boggling to me to think about what is she going to be like when, you know, she's just in elementary school, right? If we're doing this at 2 years old and teaching her these concepts. So that's something that's very fulfilling for me as well. And I think that's what lights our fire, right? Is it keeps us excited and makes our day interesting. If we can get that fulfillment as we're doing our job, we're not only making an impact on our team, the organization, but we're kind of filling up our own cup in the process. So it lights a fire under us as well.
I could tell you doing those things for your kids make a huge difference. So I've worked with a lot of early talent people right out of college, right out of boot camps or whatnot. And I didn't realize how well prepared some students are basically from the time they're young. You know, how many camps they went over the summer, how many training things they did, how much support and growth they've had versus other people who, like, you know, maybe their parents didn't know or didn't have the capability of doing those things. You know, and these are smart, talented people. They had a job at a local grocery store, went to college, did their thing. And then, but there's already years behind someone who's just starting out who had some of those things. I didn't understand the difference and where, you know, for myself or anyone else until I start seeing it with other people. That's actually when I started augmenting like my hirings. You know, if I would have 200 roles, I'd reserve some for people who just didn't have the experience or didn't have, you know, those things, even though like the other people could probably more likely make me more successful more quickly. Because personally, I want to make sure some of those people get, you know, their chance.
And it's, you know, it makes me think about a comment that I made earlier about, you know, there is a talent shortage, and that shortage is there's going to be a bigger gap in that shortage because there's two major things that are causing that and causing that to get wider in the future. And, you know, we need to really start looking at tapping into other, we need to innovate the way that we're building teams, right? And this is something that we've mastered and that we're helping organizations do, is that we need to have an intelligent way that we're in a very strategic way that's aligned with the organization. And as the future unfolds, the challenges that continue to develop of how to scale those teams intelligently and scale those capabilities. And it's not the old antiquated way of just looking at the resume and what they've done. Like, you're missing out on a lot of great talent and a lot of other aspects of a person that could come in and ramp up quickly in some skill sets, but then surpass some of these other people that may already have some of these skill sets. And so, of course, it's a case-by-case basis, but it's important that we broaden our horizons here and really start looking at the human science behind this stuff. And you know, mentorship is a big part of that, right? Like, if you're obviously passionate about mentorship, can you help us to really understand how companies can really institutionalize mentorship programs?
I think the things that we teach our executives, we need to start teaching to everybody else. And then it's specifically around the risk taking and the initiative. So when you get a new role, right, you walk into a new office, it's almost like walking into an acquaintance's or maybe a coworker's home for the first time, right? You've talked to each other, but you're not really cordial. You don't really know each other very well. So you sit in the exact seat you're supposed to sit in. You don't get totally comfortable. You stay off of certain topics. The more non-traditional a person is who comes into the workplace, the more that is. They're uncomfortable, the more they don't want to upset you, the more they don't want to. So they take a lot less risk, they take a lot less initiative, and they wait for you to guide them on every little thing. So to take those people from those non-traditional platforms, it is really a lot of conversations and a lot of sitting with them shoulder to shoulder and reaffirming all the time that what you're doing is fine, what you're doing is great. And you need to just take a risk, just do it. Live in risk, live in ambiguity. It's going to be okay. Like, you're not going to do anything so bad that, you know, within a few hours. There are things you can do. Don't get me wrong. I'm sure somebody out there has got an idea, but for 99% of the time, it's going to be okay. And that's helped out a whole bunch, I've noticed. And I'm talking like people I've worked with in the background, single moms, people who worked at gas stations prior and gotten their first job as a software developer, people who took maybe 2 semesters of school and they went to a boot camp. So all sorts of backgrounds. The problem we have with the traditional hiring method right after the resume is I sit you down, I say, okay, good, you did HR. Now here's your IDE, get it up and running. And then most devs after that, like they say, oh, I ran into this issue. I don't know what to do. The dev solves it for them and then walks away. And my approach is really, I broke down all the ambiguity, walked through every technology in the tech stack. And we visited 2, 3 times. And then I didn't walk away until they committed code to production. And just to remove all that ambiguity and then reaffirming them on all our one-on-ones saying, just do it. Just do it. Don't wait for me. Just do it. You know, and it's a mentality you build over time. The cool thing about that is culturally that grows. And what we saw at GE Digital when we built it there is 3 years later, everyone had that mentality, right? So mid-level devs, senior devs, when they brought people in, so it wasn't me doing it, other people were doing it. So.
Yeah, that's good. I mean, it takes time. You're not going to snap your fingers and you're just going to change overnight, but it makes me think about, what I constantly telling my team. I just had this conversation earlier today, with marketing is like, you've got to get it in your mindset that it's okay to make mistakes, right? M maybe where you were before, you were, yelled at, reprimanded, whatever, right? For making mistakes, it's different here. It's like if you're not making mistakes, there's a problem because that means fear is holding you back from innovating and pushing things forward and helping us to evolve and get better and better and better. You're gonna make mistakes if you're doing that. And so we need to embrace them, just own up to them, and say, hey, I made a mistake. Well, let's look at it. How can we get better next time? What can we learn from it? And that's the way to continuous improvement. So it's so important to instill that confidence in your people, right? And keep reinforcing that and reinforcing that. I think science says that people have to hear things 7 times before it really sinks in and they really start to believe it, especially if they've been in a bad experience before to where it was the opposite of a culture. So important. We're coming up close to time here, but I wanted to ask you a few more questions before we kind of close things out for this episode. Could you help us to understand your opinion and just maybe elaborate on your view of technology, on the view that technology alone is insufficient without like human involvement?
It just kind of goes down to like, what's the point, right? Like, we get excited for technology's sake, especially if you deal with a lot of early talent, people get really excited about it. But you got to remember, there is a point to all of this, all this new features, all these new framework. You get a new framework, it's to make you as the developer's life easier. You know, it wasn't to build it. As you build a new feature, it's changing someone's life as the way they operate day to day. They press less buttons, or they press more. There is an element to everything. I think we tend to forget about that. And when you keep your eyes focused on who are our customers and who are we impacting, it makes your goals and your priorities a lot more clear. So sometimes if you're asking yourself, I don't know exactly what we should be working on next, we have these two options. Ask yourself, do you know your customers? Do you know the impact you're doing?
Yeah, it's so important. It makes me think of Stephen Covey. Actually one of my neuroscience teachers gave this to us for extra credit, which was awesome. And it was read the book by Stephen Covey, The 7 Habits of Highly Effective People, right? And then do like a book report on it. And very good book. And in there it's begin with the end in mind, right? Is like, what are you trying to accomplish? And who is it affecting, right? Or where are you trying to make that impact? And if we kind of keep that end in mind, it helps us to really, bite the bullet where and come out of our comfort zones because there's a purpose behind it and it's going to benefit us and benefit the end user. Ultimately, that's going to come back to you as helping to move that needle forward. So Dustin, in your opinion, what technology does the world need that doesn't exist yet?
Something that either reminds us or removes the ambiguity of what we say and what we meant. Even when you're in the same domain and you're working with people, the more perspectives and the more diversity we bring in the room, the more easier it is to misinterpret what we're talking about. I was in a room last week of 50 people. All of them had at least 8 years of experience. We're all working for the same company. It was amazing how many words were overloaded and, you know, used one way here and another way there. So any kind of technology that would just make what I'm saying actually clear to the person hearing it, that would be what I need the most, I think.
Yeah, I forget what movie I saw that on, but it's like, you know, it makes me think about these technologies that are like, you know, it's like you're communicating with an alien or something, right? And you put these earplugs in and you can actually understand what they're saying. Yeah, but
universal translator in Star Trek.
Yeah, maybe something. But the majority of communication is not the words that you're saying, right? There's so many other aspects to communication. So you're going to need that, you know, visual AI to kind of, you know, be watching the people as well. So, So, we're coming up on closing here, Dustin. Really appreciate you joining us today and sharing your insights. You know, we're both obviously passionate about driving the tech community forward. Can you help the audience really understand how they can leverage some of the things that you're doing in New Orleans?
Yeah. So if you want to get involved in anything New Orleans, go to noladevs.org. It's a website we built this year. But, you know, I would say, if you want to get involved, just start doing something. Talk to the people and get involved. Last year, no one gave me permission to start up the meetups. No one's been giving anybody else. It's really just people just stepping up and doing it. And if you don't want to do something that big or maintain, find one person and mentor. And, you know, find one person. There's something you can do that you can help out that one person. So, but yeah, specifically in New Orleans, noladevs.org. We have all of our events there. Come meet us up. But yeah, find a person and help them out.
Yeah, it's so important, the community aspect of it. It will, by helping somebody out, it grows you so much. And I know that I think we were talking earlier and you mentioned that you had an event coming up in January and then consistently through the year, you've got events coming up.
So this year was all about growth and getting the meetups up and running. And this next year is more about getting us a point, getting us a little bit focused and actually help giving back to the community. Idea Village, we're partnering with them and they're a tech incubator. So a startup incubator. And right now we're having an event on January 30th called Pitch to Tech, where these non-technical founders will be introduced to a bunch of engineers, college seniors and bootcamp graduates and just tenured engineers in the city to be CTOs, to be technical mentors, you know, whatever kind of relationship we can build there. So super exciting.
Perfect. That's awesome. So listeners, be sure to check out Dustin's work and follow him on social media. Website links and social handles will be in the show description. So finally, before we end today, Dustin, you know, from our conversation today, what's one piece of actionable advice that you want to leave the audience with?
Just do. Get involved. Don't stress out about, like, you don't know something. If you see a problem, chances are other people see a problem too. And again, they take that executive mindset. Take a little bit of risk. Manage the ambiguity and, you know, and enjoy yourself.
Yeah. So important. Really great having you, Dustin, and you know, looking forward to the continued conversations and having you back on the show, maybe in the future. Audience, don't forget to help your fellow tech humans, share this podcast and follow me on LinkedIn at Javier Guerra 360. See you next time on the Tech Human Experience.
The Tech Human Experience.